This is Law and Disorder.
This week on Law and Disorder, we'll have Anjana Malhotra from the ACLU and Human Rights Watch discussing the Department of Justice abuse of the material support provision.
Since when our government can simply pick people up, hold them in prison, and never give them a trial under so-called material witness warrants?
Ben Weisner, attorney for the Carr family, will discuss an American citizen caught up in Iraq, held by the U.S. military for 54 days under no laws.
Human life is cheap for this Bush administration. They can pick you up, throw you in jail, even if you're a citizen, and never let you out until you file a lawsuit.
Renowned attorney Leonard Weinglass will join us to discuss the L.A. 8.
18 years of trying to deport people who were supporting the cause of Palestinian rights. Three times the L.A. 8 have won their case.
Barbara Olshansky and Joe Covell will join us to discuss the World Tribunal on Iraq. All that and more on Law & Disorder today.
I'm Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
I'm Dahlia Hashad, Arab Muslim South Asian advocate for the ACLU. Welcome to Law and Disorder. Heidi Boghossian and Michael Stephen Smith are out today.
We want to give a special welcome to one of our new affiliates, an important one, radio station KRFC, Fort Collins, Colorado. We know we have a lot of friends there, and we're really pleased that they are carrying the show. Thank you, KRFC.
The World Tribunal on Iraq investigated various issues on Iraq, including the legality of the war, the role of the United Nations, war crimes, and the role of the media, as well as the destruction of the cultural sites and the environment in Iraq. The gathering was held in Istanbul, Turkey, and modeled after the International War Crimes Tribunal that British philosopher Bertrand Russell formed in 1967 during the Vietnam War. We have with us today Barbara Olshansky with the Center for Constitutional Rights. She traveled to Istanbul for the tribunal. She's author of several books, America's Disappeared, Secret Imprisonment, Detainees, and the War on Terror, Against War with Iraq, and Secret Trials and Executions. Barbara testified at the tribunal. Let's listen to part of what she had to say.
The United States government's unlawful and covert practices started very early on. And I'm just going to say this to give people a picture of how quickly this administration seized on an opportunity to repress people. Within one day of the attacks on the United States, the government started rounding up in excess of 1,500 people. That's a guess. We'll never know how many. Immigrants and foreign visitors to the United States of Middle Eastern origin and or of the Muslim faith, and put them in jails and detention centers around the United States, and ordered the guards at those jails to lie to the attorneys who came to the jails and to lie to the foreign consulates about who was imprisoned there. This was a deliberate order of our Attorney General then, John Ashcroft, to lie to everyone that came to the door about who was there. And when we filed under our federal law seeking information about who had been arrested, because people had come to us and said, they took my husband, my brother, my son, my nephew, and I don't know where they went. And we had to go literally door to door to try and find people. And when we asked under this law, this information law, about how many people were taken, what was the justification, whether they had attorneys, whether their families knew, whether their consulates were advised, whether they could make calls, we got an answer from our Department of Justice that we were not entitled to know. Last piece I'll say about it. With the creation of Guantanamo also comes an exponential growth in the CIA's Extraordinary Rendition Program. Under this program, United States Special Forces charter private jets and fly around the world and pick up people. Now, these are not usually enemy combatants. For those, we, I think, use our regular own Army and Air Force planes. These are people that are seized, hooded, and shackled, brought out surreptitiously from the country where they're captured, and sent to third countries for interrogation under torture at the United States' request. I'm sure some people have read about this. It happened to two Egyptian men who were taken from Sweden. It happened to people that were traveling from one flight to another in JFK Airport and ended up in Syria for a year being tortured. And this, what the CIA calls their snatch and grab operations, has been confirmed by CIA officials and now private citizens who have helped to set up the operations for the charter companies. These are the things that started with Guantanamo. What they prove, and I guess why someone who is much wiser than me understood when they asked me here today, is that they prove that every statement made by the United States government about abuses in Abu Ghraib, abuses elsewhere in Iraq, being the work of a few rogue individuals is a monstrous lie. It could not be anything else other than a monstrous lie, because these policies started in Guantanamo. And we now know that they started at the request of those highest up in the administration. And they have been going on from Guantanamo through to the present. They are certainly not the policies of single individuals. What they also show is that while this has been going on, there has been a failure of leadership in the United States. Neither the judiciary nor Congress has been able to hold back this tide of militarism and brutality committed by the military and by the Bush administration. And that is why I think it's important for me to be here today to see that there are so many people to work with to try and rein in a rogue country that has alienated itself and the rest of the world from the people of the United States. Thank you.
That was Barbara Olshansky speaking at the War Crimes Tribunal in Istanbul. She's here with us today. Welcome to Law and Disorder, Barbara.
Thank you for having me.
Barbara, why the need for the World Tribunal on Iraq?
I think it served several purposes. I think in some ways it's intended to fill a gap that has been created by the United States government's reluctance to participate in international institutions. For the world community, there's really no way to hold the United States responsible for war crimes. The Rome Statute is the United States is not a part of, and so, you know, no U.S. government official can be tried before the International Criminal Court. Because of that gap, there is a tremendous need for people to show the world what the United States is doing and try and hold them accountable in the public eye. And that really is the purpose of the World Tribunal. It's a way for people to express what they've experienced, for the world to see what the United States has done, and for people to hold the United States accountable throughout the world.
So who testified? Who was providing evidence and testimony?
It was quite an amazing array of people. There were people from all over the world. There were human rights activists from the field. There were eyewitnesses to what can only be called United States atrocities in Iraq. There were academicians, human rights lawyers, and scientists and doctors. And everyone in their area of expertise gave testimony.
Were there any Iraqi civilians?
Yes. Those were the eyewitnesses that I was referring to. It was an incredible group of women and men that took some personal risk coming across the border to testify in Istanbul. A number of people were actually arrested trying to come across, and it took them 3 days to get out. But quite a few did come. One or two were journalists. One was a woman lawyer, one of the very few human rights lawyers on the ground in Iraq, trying to do work while the United States is still occupying that country. And then women who had been in Fallujah during the siege and the bombing, who have been in other parts of the country and experienced what the United States has done.
Barbara Olshansky, Associate Legal Director for the Center for Constitutional Rights, is with us discussing the World Tribunal on Iraq and her testimony and what she witnessed there. Tell us about some of the testimony that the jury was responding to.
Yeah, they actually asked questions after each panel, and the panels were really quite fascinating. Some of the really compelling ones, besides the eyewitnesses, were a testimony given by a scientist, Dr. Thomas Sass, about the United States' use of depleted uranium weapons in Iraq. And the United States had first used them in the first Gulf War. And so he did this analysis of cancer and leukemia rates in children, starting before 1991, when the first war was, so that you could have a baseline, and then going afterwards. And what you saw was, you know, a 300-fold increase in the rates of leukemia in children under nine. That was quite, you know, powerful testimony, scientific testimony. And of course, there's confirmed evidence of the use of depleted uranium weapons currently by the United States. And so, of course, that trend, that increase, is likely to continue.
The jury, after hearing the testimony, the jury of conscience issued a verdict. In part, it read, "Recognizing the right of the Iraqi people to resist the illegal occupation of their country and to develop independent institutions, and affirming that the right to resist the occupation is the right to wage a struggle for self-determination, freedom, and independence as derived from the Charter of the United Nations, we, the jury of conscience, declare our solidarity with the people of Iraq." I imagine the U.S. and the U.K. government find this to be quite inflammatory.
I haven't heard the response, but I would guess that you're right. Although, when you speak to all of these people, who all the doctors and the lawyers and the human rights activists who consider themselves the new Iraq that they are trying to develop while the United States is there, it doesn't sound so radical. It is really very, it's you and me in Iraq trying to find a way to rebuild our society and having difficulty doing that because the United States, for example, has targeted hospitals. And because there's no water and no electricity, there's no way to sterilize equipment, and people are dying of blood poisoning. And so when you're resisting that kind of bombing, you're doing it in the name of humanitarian relief. And so it doesn't sound at all like, oh, my God, there's a terrorist insurgency. It's really not that. It's a doctor saying, you must stop bombing hospitals because we have no way of treating anyone then. That's not a radical idea at all, but that never is how it is portrayed in the United States press.
Barbara Olshansky with the Center for Constitutional Rights, thank you.
Thank you.
This week, the USA Patriot Act is being used retroactively to prosecute immigrants for political activity. Seven Arab Americans and one Kenyan, here legally for decades, have been in legal and personal limbo for 18 years as the United States has sought to deport them for political activity under various laws. The LA-8, as they came to be known, were originally charged under McCarthy-era anti-communism laws. The U.S. government sought to deport them due to their visible and vocal advocacy for Palestinian and human rights. Now the government's using the USA Patriot Act to deport them. Ahilan Arulananthem from the ACLU, Mark Vanderhout, and David Cole of the Center for Constitutional Rights will be trying the case this week.
I think they'll be working along with Lenny Wineglass as well, Dahlia.
Yeah, he's been long active on that case.
Now, as I recall, just to give a little bit of background, I was working at the Center for Constitutional Rights 18 years ago, when I remember getting a fax, and David Cole was there as well as a young attorney, and it said that eight so-called alleged members or supporters of the PFLP, which was the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, and there's different factions of that, but were being arrested for what they claimed at that point was advocating the views of world communism.
And that was in 1987.
Right, and that's, as you said, the McCarran-Walter Act stuff that said that anyone who advocates communism or world communism could be deported from the United States, any non-citizen. And Cole, et cetera, the whole crowd litigated that issue for quite a while. Eventually, that McCarran-Walter Act, which is where the communist provision came from, was tossed out. And then they decided to prosecute them under other kinds of provisions, two of them for very technical immigration violations. And they said, and then the lawyers made an argument that said you're only picking on them for these technical immigration violations because they've spoken out in support of Palestinian rights and for a Palestinian homeland.
With us, we have attorney Leonard Wineglass. Many of you will know Leonard Wineglass from his representation of people such as Mumia Abu-Jamal, Amy Carter, and over his representation for the LA 8. Leonard Wineglass, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Yes, thanks you for having me.
Hey, Lenny, it's Michael Ratner. How are you?
Okay, how are you, Michael?
So when does the trial start, Lenny?
Well, it was supposed to start this week, but in a surprise move, the judge, without our petitioning him and on his own order, called off the hearings without saying exactly why. We're awaiting a decision on that.
Are you serious?
Yes, it happened very suddenly, and it happened just as we finished arguing the motions, most of which he denied. We thought it was over. We were getting ready for the hearing beginning on Monday, and suddenly we got a message from the court. The hearings are off.
And no one's asked for extra time or more time at this point.
We haven't.
So what do you have any idea?
No, it's just speculation. There were issues where the government hadn't complied with outstanding orders, and I think it troubled the judge that we would go to a hearing without having received the discovery we were entitled to.
Let me ask you something, Lenny. This trial concerns only two of the LA 8, is that right?
That's right. But the other six, I should say five, one is returned to the Middle East. The other five have their hearings in a state of suspension awaiting the result of this case.
What are the real legal issues in this case?
There are really just two issues. One, whether or not the money that they raised at public events was raised for the PFLP and got to the PFLP, and secondly, whether or not that money that went to the PFLP was used for military purposes.
Now, when they raised this money, what was the status of the PFLP in this country?
At that time, the PFLP, so far as I know, was not on a list, but later became on a list.
Right. So at the time they did this, and I think that's right, what my knowledge is as well, they were raising money for an organization that was completely legal to raise it for.
Yes, that's my understanding. However, I have to qualify that in this way. The case was tried before a federal judge, Judge Wilson in Los Angeles. Judge Wilson ruled in our favor. The Supreme Court in 1999, Justice Scalia writing the opinion, reversed the federal judge in Los Angeles, brought us back to this stage. At that point, Judge Wilson reviewed the entire scope of evidence that the prosecution had against the 8. And Judge Wilson found that the government was unable to prove that any of the monies went to the PFLP. And I think that still remains true.
So that even if somehow, which seems unlikely to me, the PFLP was not a legal place you could give money to, the second or the first line is that, what are you guys talking about? None of the money we raised went to the PFLP. Is that right?
That's right. And I don't think the government, from looking at the discovery materials, is able to prove that. They attempt to prove it circumstantially. For instance, in an event, a public event held in Glendale, California. 1,200 people attended, families. It was a social cultural event. The event occurred on the 18th anniversary of the founding of the PFLP. Aha, the government says. That proves that the money was raised for the PFLP. However, we have the tapes, and the government has the tapes, of the speeches that were made. And the speeches do not in any way indicate that the money was to go to the PFLP. As a matter of fact, the checks that were made out to U.S. Omen, a charitable organization which isn't on anyone's list. So there was no talk at that meeting, that public meeting, that the money is to go for military purposes. As a matter of fact, the talk was the opposite. The money was to go to the exile community in the West Bank for schools and medical services.
So Lenny, it's 18 years now. What's going on? Why is the government persisting in this? Through all through Republicans and Democrats. I mean, this was still going on during Clinton's years.
That is the critical question. The case actually has been litigated three times. Each time we've won, except for Scalia reversing us in the Supreme Court. Then 2001 happened, the Patriot Act was passed, and now we face Patriot Act charges.
What are the charges under the Patriot Act?
The charges are giving material support to a terrorist organization.
So even though this was not considered a terrorist organization at the time the government's accusing them of giving the money, they can still be charged.
They can still be charged. Immigration law allows for retroactivity. It allows for double jeopardy. It allows for selective prosecution. Justice Scalia, in his opinion reversing our case, specifically held that the United States government may discriminate amongst immigrant communities to decide which communities should be deported or be held deportable and which not.
So what does this mean for immigrants under the Patriot Act? If you give to a charitable organization today and it's not on any terrorism list, and then tomorrow it makes the State Department list of designated terrorist organizations, what happens? Can you be prosecuted for that?
I think that would raise a very good question about at the time that you gave, if the organization was not on any terrorist list. I have to say this. Back in 1986, when the money was raised, the PFLP allegedly was involved in some hijackings of aircraft, and it was involved allegedly in assassinations. But it preceded the drawing up of lists. So it was denominated, because of some of its early history, as an organization that engaged in terrorism.
But then it also had the humanitarian aid wing of it.
Yes, largely so. I mean, the amount that was engaged in so-called militarist activities was very small, a very small percentage. At the time that they raised money for these activities, the PFLP was running hospitals, schools, and social work activities in the occupied territories. And that was clearly the function of the events that they held to raise money.
What's interesting, Lenny, I remember this period because this was a period where there were always these issues, giving to the African National Congress.
That's right.
Yeah, they engaged in, you know,
They were considered to be an organization that engages in terrorist activities.
Right, but you could also give to, like, the hospitals or to free Nelson Mandela.
Yes.
And you wouldn't be considered guilty of anything in the 70s and the 80s when you did this.
That's true. They really sought to make an example on the Palestinian issue. We were able to prove in court, and I participated in this hearing, that there are many organizations that give money to Cuban organizations that are engaged in terrorist actions directed at Cuba. And we put witnesses on the stand who were engaged in that fundraising. And they confessed to it, and they weren't citizens. But there was no one seeking to deport them. As a matter of fact, the witness we put on the stand said the only time that he was threatened by deportation is when he stopped.
That's what I think, Lenny, when you mentioned the loss that the LAA and you guys suffered in the Scalia opinion. What's so remarkable about that? But that's, as I recall, what that says is you can actually discriminate against various classes of non-citizens. You can decide to go after the people who are supporting Palestinian causes, but not the people who are supporting, you know, the violent overthrow of Cuba.
And we'll
you're exactly right. And that is explicitly what Justice Scalia wrote. There was no hidden language in that opinion. You're right. They just said the United States government is entitled to discriminate when it decides who and on what basis a person should be deported if they are not a citizen. Over the last 18 years, we've been through this many times where the case starts, we win issues, it stops for a while, and then the government restarts it again. So I ask your listeners to just stand by and keep a watchful eye. This case is off just now, but I'm afraid it might be put back on very shortly.
You'll find updates on ccr.org and aclu.org, lawanddisorder.org. Let's listen to civil liberties activists demanding due process for Guantanamo detainees at the Center for Constitutional Rights protest.
They joined Eve Ensler and others on July 4th, the day of supposed freedom for the United States, when we talk about the lack of freedom if you're a non-citizen and if you're a Muslim detained around the world by the United States.
It's got to go!
Because I think it's disgusting that the United States has now come to the point where kidnapping people and imprisoning them without any fair legal process, and a lot of the prisoners in Guantanamo were sold to the U.S. forces because they were giving out basically bribes to bring people in.
And Guantanamo is a symbol of the foreign policy that is alienating the rest of the world and trashing our civil rights.
I agree with him. I don't think it's good to be having naked people just being abused and doing that kind of thing.
I don't really think that's why they're using it. I think they know full well that they can't get accurate information from people using that. I don't think they're dummies.
They're going to do this to everybody. This will become standard practice, and even citizens won't have protection.
It's really frightening. It's really frightening. I think they're using it to strike terror into people's hearts, and that we should all be afraid, because I think they full well intend to use it on us.
You know, they use national emergency rhetoric to justify it and establish a precedent that would then be applied more broadly.
They brought somebody in. Doesn't mean that person was guilty of anything. And we'll never know if these people are guilty of anything, but for sure, if they ever let them out, they will be enemies of the United States, because if you were kidnapped and held against your will for several years without any process, of course you're going to be against the United States, so it's really counterproductive.
On May 17th, Cyrus Carr, a 44-year-old American citizen from Los Angeles, an aspiring filmmaker who was in Iraq to film, was taken into custody and held by U.S. military for 54 days. Recently, he was released. We have with us his attorney from the ACLU, Ben Wisner. Ben, welcome to Law and Disorder.
It's nice to be here, Dahlia. Thanks for having me.
And Ben, this is Michael Ratner as well, and I guess he's on his way back from Iraq right now, is that right?
Yeah, he spoke to some of my co-counsel a couple of days ago, and our understanding is that he should be back in Los Angeles sometime today, Wednesday.
The ACLU actually filed a lawsuit?
We did, and it's the family's belief and Cyrus's belief that if the lawsuit had not been filed, he would still be sitting in solitary detention right down the hall from other notables like Tariq Aziz in Camp Cropper in Baghdad.
Ben, why was Cyrus picked up in the first place? Why was he being held?
You know, even in the bizarre world of post-9/11 American detention policies, this is a very bizarre case. Cyrus is, as you said in the lead-in, a United States citizen. He was born in Iran but grew up mostly in the U.S. He served in the United States Navy. And a few years ago, he took a great interest in the ancient Persian ruler Cyrus the Great, his namesake, and undertook a documentary film project and had traveled around the world compiling footage, interviews about Cyrus the Great. That eventually inevitably took him to Iraq, which is the site of the ancient city of Babylon. Cyrus was in Iran at the time. He asked permission from the United States authorities, from the Iraqi authorities, and from the Kurdish authorities, and received permission from all of them to enter Iraq. And we now know that he was in Iraq for about 2 weeks before his arrest, shooting footage. He was taking a taxi from his hotel to a place where he was going to conduct an interview, and the taxi was stopped at a regular checkpoint. And at that checkpoint, Iraqi police checked the taxi and found what they claim were 30 or so washing machine timers, which again they say can be used to construct bombs. So Cyrus and his Iranian filmmaker and the taxi driver were all taken into custody.
So he had with us an Iranian cameraman?
He did. He had been working for a year and a half with an Iranian cameraman.
What happened to him?
Well, that's quite interesting. You know, Cyrus, of course, had an American passport. And so after some time, we don't know how long, I'm waiting to speak to him about this, he was transferred to U.S. Detention, and he was put in Camp Cropper, which is where high-level Iraqi detainees are held. Saddam Hussein is there, Tariq Aziz, and Cyrus Carr was there. The Iranian filmmaker was tossed in Abu Ghraib, and from secondhand accounts, you know, we know that he was sharing a tent with many people. He reports that people had to, you know, urinate into cans. He apparently had a much rougher time than Cyrus did.
And I mean, he's still in?
Well, no. The United States military has announced that he was released when Cyrus was released.
And the taxi driver?
The taxi driver we don't know anything about. I've heard that he's still in detention. Cyrus described him to two Los Angeles Times reporters as somewhat of a shady guy.
Now, what's amazing to me is, I think, you know, I read the Times piece and I noticed you guys filed the lawsuit, but essentially for 50-some days, there was no movement on this case by the government, even though it's obvious that the minute you filed the lawsuit, they say, well, we obviously have nothing to keep this guy as an American citizen. I mean, that must be the only conclusion I can draw from it.
Well, what Cyrus said to one of my co-counsel was, I wasn't treated badly by the Americans. I was just stuck in a cell and forgotten about. And he really believes that but for all of the media attention from the lawsuit and the lawsuit itself, he would still be there. He was, after his release, in a hotel room in Baghdad, and there was a knock on his door, and there was a crowd of reporters there to interview him. And at that moment, he realized why he had been released after all this time. You know, I should say, we heard this story. Our Los Angeles office was contacted by Cyrus's family members after they had spent weeks trying to get him out through other means. They had contacted Senator Boxer's office. They had contacted the State Department. They had been told by the FBI, which had seized his property from his Los Angeles apartment and then returned it, that Cyrus was cleared, that he would soon be released, that they did not need to contact counsel, that they should just wait because he'd be home soon. And it was really their frustration that led them finally to contact the ACLU.
How did they know that he was being held in the first place if he was thrown in a cell and forgotten about?
Cyrus was allowed, over the course of those 7 or 8 weeks of detention, 3 brief monitored telephone conversations with his family in the United States. And so the first that they knew where he was, the first they heard was on, I think, the 24th of May, when Cyrus's aunt in Los Angeles got a phone call from Cyrus. He was not worried at that time. He really did believe that he'd be released soon. And it was really after the third phone call, which was a month later, that Cyrus showed his frustration when he was told by his Los Angeles relatives that the FBI had cleared him, that the FBI had informed the relatives that Cyrus had passed a lie detector test. At that point, he was extremely frustrated. So to continue, when the ACLU first learned of Cyrus's detention, we also pursued avenues other than litigation to get him released because it sounded like a mistake. And so we made contacts with the Defense Department and the State Department to see if they could give us any answers. And only when they did not give us any answers did we go to federal court in Washington, D.C. and file a habeas corpus petition saying that there was no lawful basis for Cyrus's detention.
No, it's just noticeable to me, Ben, that in a number of these cases, some American citizens, some non-citizen, that they do nothing until you actually get into court and they're forced to try and justify the detention. And at that point, they have nothing to say.
Well, I think that they realized, you know, we filed the lawsuit a week ago today, last Wednesday, and Judge Robertson, the federal district court in Washington, D.C., scheduled a hearing for Monday, 3 working days later, at which the government had to justify Cyrus's detention. And it was over that weekend that Cyrus was released. And I think the government realized that even though they've not hesitated to take extreme positions in court cases to try to test their authority and see how far they can go, that the facts in this case were absolutely appalling, that there was little chance that a federal judge would allow them to hold somebody for absolutely no reason, and that they were better off taking their shot on some other case.
Now, what are you guys going to do next with this case? I mean, he could conceivably sue for damages, although difficult, but I'm just interested in what your plans are.
Yeah, you know, we agreed as a legal team that we were not going to make any decisions based on our conversations with Cyrus while he was still in Iraq, that we wanted to wait until he returned to the United States so that we could have a better debriefing with him, so that we could hear about the conditions of his confinement both by the Iraqis and by the Americans. One absolutely upsetting part of this story that has not been reported is that all of Cyrus's property was destroyed. His passport was destroyed by the FBI when they were trying to verify it. But much worse than that from Cyrus's point of view is that 20 hours of footage that he had carefully taken in Iraq were destroyed as well. And that's really irreplaceable.
Oh, that's terrible.
And what happened was that Cyrus's property was in his hotel room. And as soon as he was detained by the Americans, he said, "Please, this is my hotel. This is my hotel room. I have a laptop computer with all of my work on it. I have my camera with all of my work on it. Can you please go and put my property in safekeeping?" And the Americans did not do that. And by the time Cyrus was released, some 2 months later, I think it's no surprise that everything was stolen.
And so the next decisions will be made when he's arrived back. Is that right?
Well, that's right. And, you know, again, it's going to be up to Cyrus whether he wants to take any other kind of legal action against the United States. This is not necessarily someone who shares our view of the government's behavior in Iraq. This, again, remember, is a military veteran. When the FBI searched his apartment in L.A., they encountered a room full of American flags, pictures of Cyrus in uniform. You know, this is not someone who I think would be inclined to...
You know, on what basis they searched his apartment in L.A.?
Well, it's a good question, and I wondered myself whether the FBI could possibly have gotten a warrant to do that. And my best guess, and this is something we'll ask Cyrus, is that he gave the FBI in Baghdad permission to do that.
Right.
So if they can take this man, an Army veteran, completely patriotic, in line with what the government is, the administration is doing in Iraq, they can take him into custody and throw him in jail under no legal authority. What does that mean for others who are in Iraq, let's say, for, you know, humanitarian aid purposes, etc.?
Well, we know that, and the government has even conceded that 75% or 80% of the Iraqis who were being held at Abu Ghraib at the time of the scandal were people who had been inadvertently swept up in the government's raids, were people who were not insurgents. We know their error rate is high. I fear the government will not acknowledge any real limits on its authorities to detain people in a shooting war zone. And I'm very pleased that they released Cyrus Carr, but all that means is that it will be another case and not Cyrus's where we go into a U.S. court to test the government's authority to behave this way.
Let me ask you this. What do you think would have happened to Cyrus and only a non-citizen?
Well, I think that if Cyrus were a non-citizen captured in a shooting war zone, it would be a much harder argument to make from a constitutional standpoint that he had a right of access to a federal court in the United States to challenge his detention. I think that's a case that will be brought. It has not been brought yet. I think that probably most judges will acknowledge a difference between Guantanamo and Iraq, although we have to make sure that courts don't make a rule that would allow the government just to transfer people from Guantanamo to Iraq to avoid jurisdiction.
Yeah, so, when we actually thought about the Guantanamo arguments, we decided to go for the broader argument that you could basically sue on behalf of a non-citizen detained anywhere in the world by the United States. And the court, of course, gave a ruling that one could read both ways, saying it's just Guantanamo or it's anyone outside the world. So that, as you said, is as yet to be tested, really.
I mean, it looks bad if you're an American citizen, worse if you're a non-citizen, and one can only imagine if you're an Iraqi citizen. Ben Wisner from the ACLU, thank you.
Thanks so much for having me.
Ben.
Operating under a cloak of secrecy, the Department of Justice has locked up at least 70 Muslim men it is considered terrorist suspects, even though there was no probable cause to arrest them. The government has gotten around that bedrock requirement of the criminal justice system by claiming the men were material witnesses under the material witness statutes. With us, we have lawyer Anjana Malhotra, who, working with the ACLU and Human Rights Watch, spent 2 years finding these men who the Department of Justice refused to name or identify, and interviewing them. Anjana, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thanks. It's good to be here.
Anjana, you recently released a report entitled Witness to Abuse, Human Rights Abuses Under the Material Witness Law Since September 11th. And it got a lot of press, but very few people actually know what the material witness law is.
The material witness law is a little known law. You're right, Dahlia. It was enacted in its current form in 1984 to hold witnesses who may have important testimony for a criminal proceeding and who are likely to flee if served with a subpoena. Before September 11th, this law was used mainly to hold witnesses who were going to testify in a mafia trial, for example, and who were threatened with their life and afraid to testify, so they would flee if served with a subpoena. Or it was used to hold undocumented immigrants in smuggling cases where the immigrant might be deported.
In the vast majority of cases, something like over 90% of those cases, undocumented workers were held.
That's right. Basically, the government would hold these undocumented immigrants to testify against the smuggler who brought them in, because otherwise the immigrant may be released and then may be deported under immigration law. Or sometimes the smuggler was a pretty scary guy, so the immigrant that was brought in under the smuggler's control may be afraid to testify against the smuggler.
So then how did this law come to be used after 9/11 against Muslims?
Well, the government, as you know, Ashcroft had a mandate out to use every tool possible to hold anyone the government thought was suspicious. The material witness law took on a new use under Ashcroft, where the government would just pick up and hold anyone, regardless of whether they had cooperated with the government, regardless of what they may or may not have known. The government took those people under the material witness law, especially in cases where the government thought they were suspicious. So if the government got a tip, and the tip wasn't good enough to verify or to substantiate a probable cause showing as required under the Fourth Amendment to pick up a suspect, and say the Muslim man who was the object of the tip was an undocumented immigrant, the government would pick up that person and say that that particular suspicious person that the government felt was suspicious was a witness to something. But the question that every witness asked was, what are they a witness to? So basically, the government just transformed, you know, this basic power, you know, to hold someone so they will testify and help the criminal justice process, to pick up Muslim men who they just felt to be suspicious but couldn't prove to be suspicious under the criminal laws and under the constitutional requirements.
Your report, Witness to Abuse, is available on the ACLU website, aclu.org, and we'll put it up on our website as well, lawanddisorder.org. In addition to explaining the law and the stories, you also have personal accounts from your interviews with these men. And from one of the Evansville Eight, he says, "No one said anything about why we are witnesses. The next day, they took us from the detention center to the federal building, and we saw a judge around 5 or 6 p.m. We were waiting all day in a cell in jail. No one was telling us anything. We asked, 'What's going on? We're material witnesses for what?' No one knew what was going on. It felt like we would not see our family ever again. We don't know why we're here. We're thinking, who will send our families money? What's going on? What happened?" And throughout the report, you get a sense that there is a complete bewilderment across the board of everyone who's picked up as a material witness. They have no idea why they've been arrested. Someone just walked into their home one day, picked them up, threw them in a government vehicle, threw them in jail, and told them nothing. They just disappeared into jail.
Yeah, it was seeing what happened to them, you know, 2-3 years later, and how they still live with the very difficult experience of being locked in prison, not knowing why, being away from their families, not being able to make a phone call, not being able to see a lawyer. They live with both that very difficult, traumatic experience. Most of these men had never seen the inside of a prison cell.
So most of them are out?
Most of them are out, or they're facing other charges. The people most of the people where the government would make mistakes, they would have to face that within a few weeks, or a few months, and so are out. And actually, we can't really tell how many are in prison. We didn't start hearing about these stories until they were released. So,
how did you track them down then, if you didn't?
I reached out to different community groups around the country, different federal public defender's offices, to find out who they had done local advocacy for, when families had called these groups, these resource centers, how they had classified their husband or father's detention. And I looked through media accounts where the government leaked. You know, the government would often leak that they were arresting high profile terrorist suspects, but wouldn't say that they were material witnesses.
I think the only case that the public really heard about largely was the Brandon Mayfield case. You know, he was detained as a material witness in connection with the March 2004 bombings in Spain. The government used the Patriot Act to spy on him, to go into his home, to take over 330 photographs of his belongings, to download the contents of 4 of his computers. They took 16 DNA samples. How was the Department of Justice able to get away with abusing this law?
The Department of Justice worked on two levels. First, it brought in these witnesses, requested warrants for witnesses, accusing them in secret proceedings of having vital information to, you know, the nuclear attack, possible nuclear attacks or September 11th. And once a court heard that, it didn't really scrutinize the government's rationale, and the government made misrepresentations and colored the proceedings, making it seem as if these potential witnesses were vital, and without them, you know, the government couldn't prosecute a crime.
Even to the lawyers that were appointed or secured by the material witnesses.
Well, the lawyers often didn't have access to the full range of evidence, and the lawyers often weren't even able to have a copy of the basic affidavit that the government submitted to secure the arrest of the witnesses.
For those of you just joining us, we're with Anjana Malhotra, who spent 2 years investigating the abuse of the material witness law by the Department of Justice. In one of the cases, the lawyers had to fight to even find out what reasons there were for claiming that their clients were material witnesses, but then there was a gag order put on those lawyers, and they weren't allowed to share anything with their clients. In your report, you talk about this instance, and one of the people held as a material witness recounts his interaction with his lawyer. He says, Before we went into the court, we saw the lawyer for myself and another material witness. His friend asked, "What's going on?" The lawyer said, "I can't tell you." I said, "What do you mean you can't tell us?" The lawyer said, "It's something so, so, so big, and I can't tell you." It made me crazy. Here is my lawyer. How can he not tell me what's going on? And in that same case, the lawyer actually advised his clients to waive their rights completely. It's a shocking example of how the Department of Justice and the administration is trying to change the role of a lawyer. We see it again and again in the Lynn Stewart case, in the Guantanamo cases, in the case of the U.S. citizens held as enemy combatants on the U.S. soil. They're withholding evidence from lawyers. They're preventing them from meeting with their clients effectively. They're stopping them from doing their traditional job of zealous advocacy. You can't even do basic advocacy under these conditions.
You're absolutely right. And the government, you know, in case after case, by denying lawyers access to information, you know, we're trying to operate outside of the law, outside of very basic constitutional rights. And this report actually shows how avoiding those rights, you know, meant a sacrifice of good government, avoiding probable cause, not giving witnesses the right to counsel, resulted in mistakes, mistaken arrest after mistaken arrest. And it not only caused a toll on the family, but it was a waste of resources. It led to, you know, it misled the government into focusing on the wrong people. And it really ruined people's lives. Many of these witnesses continue to live under the shadow of suspicion while the government was using a blunt tool to arrest them and denying basic rights.
Is the government continuing to use the material witness law to arrest people improperly?
What's difficult about these arrests is that it's impossible to know. The government arrests witnesses for what they called grand jury proceedings, which the government controls exclusively and operates in complete secrecy. So we don't know, and it's, you know, it's disturbing.
It's secret secrecy like they're doing with a lot of the other post 9/11 initiatives. What's been the response to your report and you conducting this investigation? No one before you has really concentrated on bringing this very secret practice in the United States to light. This is really shedding light on something very new.
I think there's been an increased awareness, an increased interest in what this policy, what's gone on with this policy. And, you know, quite a few commentators have written editorials saying, look at how we're treating the Muslim community differently. Look at how we're applying a different set of laws. And I have read that there has been some movement in Congress to think about amending this law.
How about the Department of Justice's response?
The Department of Justice was very defensive, you know, defended each of these arrests, saying, you know, we got a warrant for each of these arrests, but kind of trying to wash its hands of the misrepresentations it made, of how it colored these proceedings to get these arrests, and ducked the fact that it apologized to almost a dozen of these witnesses, which is rare and unprecedented, and didn't even call at least 30 of almost half of these witnesses to testify.
They just detained them and then one day they're released.
That's right. Or in some cases, the government would seek a continuance when the witness was ready to testify so the government could keep interrogating the witness.
Well, the administration wasn't too happy about you investigating this and going in deep. What happened with that?
Well, about last summer, while I was in the midst of this research, I was talking to people who were still under government surveillance. The FBI gave me a phone call after I completed a round of interviews in the Midwest and asked me what I was doing. And fortunately, I'm lucky to work with organizations like Human Rights Watch and the ACLU that can handle FBI agents making queries about my work. So. But about a month later, I came under surveillance for, quite a few weeks at least. After I was writing the report, I had just completed some interviews, and it was a very difficult experience.
What happened?
I mean, the precipitating event was that I had a pass to go to the GOP convention. I went. It was a valid pass. I had full security clearance. I went with a friend who had secured the pass from an official in the government. And, you know, we were both people of color. We were stopped on our way in. We were detained, not told why we were detained, you know, very ironically. We were thrown out after about an hour of being held with dogs coming up to us, kind of sniffing what was going on. We're the only people of color that I saw coming into the convention during that period. And the next morning I woke up and I walked out of my apartment and there were men standing outside the apartment. They were
so visible.
Visible. It was visible. I was followed by the same people. I would see someone at noon near my work and at 9 at a bar that night. It was very, very intense. I lived with it for about, at least visibly, for 3 weeks. It, you know, helped me understand this the experience that these witnesses were going. It's very difficult. I've never been in jail. I've never, you know, been under suspicion.
If they want to intimidate you, they let you know they're there. And it seems like that's what they were doing with you.
Yes, it was very similar to the other surveillance that was going on around the convention that that created a very chilling effect on any kind of activism and advocacy. And it can be very debilitating. You have the power of the government watching over you, taking away your privacy, checking your every move, your every conversation. I mean, how can you talk openly? How can you even... You know, it took me a while to build a wall against sort of the scrutiny and my own conduct. I mean, it's a very powerful experience to be focused on by the government, to be viewed with suspicion. And I really became intimately aware of the power that they can have to pervade your entire life.
And that's what happened to these 70 men, almost all Muslim. Witness to abuse, human rights abuses under the material witness law since September 11th, a new and fantastic report jointly released by the ACLU and Human Rights Watch, available at aclu.org, also at lawanddisorder.org. Anjana Malhotra, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
That was Anjana Malhotra, who spent 2 years investigating the abuse of the material witness law by the Department of Justice. Visit us on the web at lawanddisorder.org. You can tell us what you think or listen to a past show. The opinions expressed on today's show are not those of the organizations for which we work. Law and Disorder is produced by Jeff Brady.